Macworld podcast number 349 for Wednesday, April 3rd, 2013. Hello again, everyone. Welcome to the Macworld podcast. I'm your host this week, Philip Michaels, and it's an iTunes-themed podcast, or rather an iTunes Store-themed podcast. Last week on Macworld.com, you may have read is the word that we're going to use. You may have read a commentary by Jonathan Seff, our own Jonathan Seff, about some of the flaws with the iTunes Store. It got us thinking, largely because it's 10 years ago this very month, the iTunes Store first opened its virtual doors and began collecting our coins for old songs that we didn't know we even wanted. And now it's grown into this massive thing with apps and movies and TV shows and books. My goodness. Well, not that Apple needs us to tell us what to do, but we thought we'd consider some of the ways that the iTunes Store could improve the way it goes about its business. And I have with me as my guest, Jonathan Seff, to talk about that very subject. Hello, John.
Hello, Phil.
And also joining us on the line from near Earth orbit is Dan Morin, who has, I'm sure, some thoughts about iTunes as well.
I'm creating opinions as we speak.
Well, very good. We'll give you some time to create those opinions, because first I'd like to talk about our sponsor. Today's sponsor is Audible.com, the leading provider of downloadable audiobooks with over 100,000 titles in virtually every genre. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. Listen to audiobooks anytime, anywhere, including on your Mac, iPhone, or iPad. Audible is offering Macworld listeners a free audiobook along with a 30-day trial. Go to www.audiblepodcast.com/Macworld to take advantage of this special offer. It's there that you'll find books like Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs, or IWAS, if that's how you roll instead. You'll find it all at www.audiblepodcast.com/Macworld. And before you do that, though, let's listen to our podcast and our discussion. John,
hello.
You have some thoughts about the iTunes Store I read on Macworld.com. Why don't you tell everyone what your beef is? Why is the iTunes Store making you sad?
Well, so the other day I was in Starbucks, as I do once in a while, and I picked up a free download of the week, and it was a TV show. And
which TV show?
It was some new Masterpiece Theater with Jeremy Piven.
Well, that is very hoity-toity.
Yes, I haven't watched it yet, but you know, I thought, oh, great! I love free stuff, and always liked more stuff from the iTunes Store. So it got me to think. You know, it's an episode. It's pretty long. It's in HD. It's more than 2 gigs for this one episode. And I thought, you know what, the iTunes Store really needs is, I don't want to download this right now, but I do want to purchase it, or in this case, put in a code. I just want to put in the code or press the buy button and have it added to my account in the cloud, because you can stream all the TV shows and movies and music that you buy from the iTunes Store without having to download them. But yet iTunes forces you to download that stuff right away. And you can pause it, you can delete the download, but it's still in your download queue, and at some point you're going to have to download that.
And this is true of anything that you purchase from the iTunes Store, whether it's songs, TV shows, apps.
Yeah, but it becomes particularly important when you're talking about video, because these are huge files. And, you know, let's say you want to catch up on a season of a TV show they really like. Downloading a season of a show in HD, you're talking 20, 30, 40 gigabytes maybe. I mean, it's a lot of bandwidth. And I don't necessarily want to download the whole thing. I know a lot of people who actually buy something, wait for it to download, and then delete it from their computer because they don't want to take up the space, but they know that they can stream it to their devices, their Apple TV, their iPad, or their computer, or they can download it when they actually want to have the files. If you're getting a whole season of a show, maybe you want to watch the first 2 episodes. You don't need 20 or 30 gigs. You just want to have those couple right there. And so I tweeted about my annoyance there, and I got a lot of people retweeting it and responding to me, and I thought, hey, this touched a nerve. Maybe other people care about it. So I wrote a story about it. And
so what was some of the feedback you got from the public at large about your complaint?
Other than your complaints are petty and, you know, the world has real problems. Why are you doing this?
Right. Your diamond shoes are pinching you. No one can change your $50 bill, sir.
But hey, it's my job to care about these sort of things. Other people can care about other things. So But in general, the response was pretty positive, and there were some suggestions people had. Someone said, well, why don't you use the wish list feature in iTunes, and then you can buy them when you're ready. But the point is, I want to buy them now. Let's say they're on sale and I want to buy them now, or let's say I'm on vacation and something, I decide I want to purchase something for whatever reason, and I do it, then stuff's going to start downloading. And a few people pointed out that, and as I wrote about too, that if you want, you can purchase stuff from the Apple TV directly, which has no storage. So when you purchase those things, they get added to your cloud account, your iTunes in the cloud, and you can start streaming that stuff. But the problem is they still get put into a master download queue. And at some point, you're going to have to download those on one of your devices in order to clear that out. And maybe the next time you purchase something, maybe you purchase one song, then magically 20 or 30 gigs are going to pop up in your download queue of TV shows that you have to download as well. So, other people definitely seem to see the problem there and the frustration there too.
Now, how does what Apple has to offer at the iTunes Store compare to some of the other online retailers out there in your experience? I'm thinking specifically of Amazon, but if you've had some experiences elsewhere, I'd love to hear about it.
Well, Amazon with music, especially Amazon MP3 Store, when you purchase an album, you can choose whether you want to download the files immediately or whether you want to add them to your cloud player. And I almost always do that when I buy something because I don't necessarily want to download it. I just want to have it accessible. So I'll buy an album, add it to my cloud player, and then I can either download it later or I can just stream it from a device like my iPhone when I want to. And I'm not forced to do it at that particular time. And with purchases of video from Amazon, they have within the Amazon app, the Amazon store app on your iOS or Android device or Kindle Fire, you can download stuff locally to be able to watch it, which is great because you still want to be able to download things locally. Because what if you're on an airplane or you're in a car, you're not always going to be wanting to stream stuff. But with that, you can choose whether you want to download it into the app or when you purchase it, it just sort of gets added to your account and you're not forced to immediately download it.
And basically what you're arguing is the major advantage of a download later feature is it lets you take advantage of sales and special offers. It lets you basically manage your bandwidth a little bit more with a little bit more sanity as opposed to just sort of starting and stopping and sitting in that Starbucks and waiting for your TV show to download so that you can watch Jeremy Piven.
I didn't try to download it from there. That would have been madness.
But, sure.
But you can imagine a time maybe you're on vacation, you don't have your computer, you have an iPhone with you, and there's a sale on season of Breaking Bad and you want to download it. If you don't have enough room on your iOS device, even if you had a good internet connection, if you don't have enough room on your iOS device, you can't even buy it because it wants to download it to you immediately. And I was talking to someone and they were mentioning, maybe Apple has some sort of contractual obligation with the content providers to deliver a download or deliver an episode or whatever, the movie to you. It might be part of the way Apple's contracts are set. Who knows? But I mean, from a user's perspective, that's not our problem. Our problem is it should be easier to deal with the stuff than being forced to do it, as soon as you purchase stuff. And if a lot of people download content only to delete it so that they don't have to keep it on their hard drive locally, that signals some sort of issue that should be addressed.
So that sort of leads into the larger topic of the iTunes Store that I wanted to talk about, and that's whether the iTunes Store has gotten a little bit too big for its britches. And Dan Morin, you've been quiet thus far while John has monopolized the conversation.
I'm sitting here nodding, stroking my chin, nodding.
Yes. What are your thoughts, if any, about the iTunes Store and the shopping experience as it's evolved over the past decade, when Apple has added all these things for us to purchase and rent and enjoy?
Well, obviously, it is a lot larger than it was when it started, right? You know, it was music 10 years ago.
And it wasn't even every record label 10 years ago.
Right, exactly. It was sort of just, you know, and they've added to that, not just in terms of expanding what's available and, you know, more music labels and stuff like that, but TV, movies, you know, apps, books, podcasts. It seems like pretty much everything now you can buy on the iTunes store, you know, with the exception of having your groceries delivered. But I'm sure that's coming at some point. But that does, you're right, that makes it kind of unwieldy at times because there's just so much to look for. And I think, you know, they've tried to improve a lot of that, especially last year. They rolled out some big changes to it. But I think there are still places where it can be difficult to just browse. That's a big problem I have is, you know, sometimes I want to go in and just sort of take a look and see what's interesting and what people are talking about. And they do try to break it up with these, you know, collections and sometimes spotlight some stuff that's new and noteworthy. But I find that, you know, in general, it can be really hard to just sort of organically click around and find things you're interested in the same way that you can on Amazon. I think I'm not entirely certain why Amazon seems to do this better. It's perhaps they just have acquired so much more data about their customers' habits. But if I want to go in and find, you know, I really liked this game, you know, I want to find some more games that are like this. I find that their recommendations can often be kind of facile in terms of like, you know, how they associate one game with another game or one app with another app or music with another music. It's not as intelligent as it could be.
It seems that the app recommendations in particular are the big problem because it's related to, well, you bought Super Stickman Golf 2 and John over here bought Super Stickman Golf 2 and John also bought Murder, Death, Kill. So obviously you too.
You must like
the same things that this guy likes.
Right. There's not enough data there. Right. It doesn't draw a complex picture in the same way that and which is surprising to me again because, you know, clearly Apple has collected a lot of information about your buying habits over the years, right? You've bought a lot of songs and apps and books. It would be interesting to see a little more cross-pollination in that in terms of like, you know, yeah, I bought these apps, but maybe there's more to be gained from figuring out what people who have bought this app and bought, you know, ebooks that I've enjoyed. Like perhaps that might provide more data points for figuring out things that I actually might really like.
Wait, you play games and read?
I mean, I try not to, you know,
I'm learning things about Dan every day.
No, he's a Renaissance man.
Indeed.
One of my objections to the App Store experience or the App Store, the iTunes experience, it's about apps in case I didn't give that away, is you mentioned browsing, Dan, and with music, that's sort of easy because you think, well, I heard the song title in the when I was out and about, I'd like to maybe download that song and see what other recordings that band has produced. So I type it into the little tiny search window and there it is. If I'm looking for, say, a note-taking app or a dictionary app, I type in note taker or dictionary and I'll get the first things that will come up will be apps that have that in the name of their title because app makers have and full credit to them, but they've kind of gamed the system where they figure out what search terms people are looking for, and that's why you wind up with apps that have 20 word names.
Right.
Maybe
dictionary
bands should do that
more.
Yes.
Book that you can look up definitions for words in.
The Grateful Dead jam band that played in the 1960s and did lots of very long songs and live versions. That can be the new name for the Grateful Dead.
See, the problem with musicians is that they're just not very SEO friendly.
Yes, exactly. So I would like that it just be easier to find apps in the app section of the iOS App Store.
I think a little more power, too, in terms of you know, you might be searching for a notes app, but what you really might want is a notes app that lets you, say, sync your notes between multiple devices, right? But
right.
There's no easy way to search on capability. You know, it's just a very sort of basic description. And obviously,
you get so many results that it's meaningless.
How do you find the ones without paging through each one and clicking on it and saying, does this do what I want to do? Or, as I'm sure you guys have done and I have, downloading like four different apps until you find one that seems to be actually the one that you want.
And that leads me into another problem with at least the app searching experience and to a certain extent songs as well. It doesn't just have to be about apps with me. But you're looking for something and you get a whole list of results. And what you have to do is click it to investigate to see if this is what you want and then click back to me and then click the new thing. I like cover versions of songs. I'm a big fan of cover versions. So I have to click one song and wait for it to stream to get the preview and then go back. And you don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole because you might never return to the original thing you were searching for. It's a little bit confusing. It doesn't feel like a very natural browsing experience the way that, say, browsing on the web would be, where you can open up a new window or a new tab to look at this new bit of information that you've come across.
Right. And I think there's also something to be said about, in terms of finding apps, there might be an app that, you know, you're really interested in, but you look at it and say, oh, this doesn't have, you know, feature X that I want, but otherwise looks pretty good. Maybe I'll come back to it and I'll add feature X. And there's not necessarily a good way. The whole update system, I mean, it's great to have free updates and you get, you know, notifications to a certain extent when updates are available for apps that you have. But the notification or the update system can be kind of tricky at times. I was thinking in particular of the other week, there's an update to an app I use and I'm installing... You know, I'm going through and installing my updates, and normally I just hit update all and let it do in the background on my iPad. And I noticed as I like just sort of paged through to see what was new, there was one of my apps had this big in all caps, "Do not download this update. It will break your app." And I was like, but okay.
Was that the Kindle app by any chance?
No, it was Plex for my iOS device. But to me, though, I mean, and that's a problem for developers really, is that they can't. If they find a bug that
they can't pull it back,
they can't remove it.
Right.
And so if you had already installed that before they even updated with that text, you're kind of out of luck until they, you know, release a patch. And sure, they're going to try to do that as quick as possible. But, you know, there are probably plenty of people who, you know, didn't see that or just hit update all blithely thinking, I'll just update all my apps and that app is broken. Right. So that's, I mean, it's nice to have, they've done a great job of popularizing the idea of app updates and making it so that people generally really do update their software. But it seems like they could use a little more complexity or at least, you know, the ability to selectively choose app update. Like, because, you know, if I just don't want to update one app, that means I've got to go through like 12 more. And
right. And that one app you don't update will stay in the app window. Right.
I'll constantly have that little one
forever. And if you just if you know you're updating your apps late at night and maybe you've had an adult beverage or two and don't quite remember that you weren't supposed to update to that app and you hit update all and then you're ruined.
It just has a way of happening.
Yeah. One of the problems that, you know, it's a good problem to have for Apple, but one of the problems for users is there are so many apps and we all have so many apps on our devices. And, you know, I know in iTunes I probably have 5-6 times as many apps as I have on my devices at any given time. And when there are updates, there are updates very often for a lot of apps. Like Dan was saying, do you want to go through and individually do them? Do you read the release notes for every single one of them? You know, just like, do you read the EULAs before you click OK on stuff?
I can't speak for Dan Morin, but I am shaking my head no.
I read every word.
I usually assume that if there's
like
an update
them.
That I want it, and I do update all because I don't want to sit there doing one at a time either.
Mm-hmm. This may be a problem that's just germane to me since I reviewed apps for 4 years, 5 years now. But these updates will come along for apps that I haven't used since 2009, since 2010, and there's no way to dismiss them and say
never.
No, I don't want to use that. I don't want to update that potty training app I downloaded to teach my daughter how to be potty trained.
Well, then you just delete it,
yeah.
Right?
But no, it's not on my phone. It's still in the
yeah.
I've deleted it from my phone and from my iPad, but still the iTunes believes that I still want all these apps that I no longer use. Again, might be specific to me because I've used a lot of apps over the years, so that not a day goes by that there aren't a dozen updates waiting for me. But I'm sure at this point, even regular users, civilians out there have downloaded their share of apps and probably have to sort through a lot of updates
yeah,
that
sure,
they don't need or want.
Absolutely, and not just for, you know, updates, but just in terms of scrolling through pages upon pages of apps too. Yeah, that's definitely comes to be a problem after a while, because we've all acquired a great deal of apps.
So we've sat around being all complainy, telling Apple what's wrong. Let's tell Apple what they could do, one way to make this experience better. Let's start with you, John Seth.
One way to make the iTunes,
the store experience better. The iTunes app itself is a whole, that's a whole separate podcast, friends. How to improve iTunes.
Well,
don't upgrade to the current version would be the first step.
Yeah, iTunes 11 has its positive features somewhere.
Somewhere.
You can't find them though, because they're surrounded by other features.
Well, there's that, but I mean, I am going to go with the search functionality, you know, that we talked about, just because it does need so much work. I was looking for some kind of like relaxation meditation type of app, you know, something to have on my phone, you know, when my boss is yelling at me or something. No, just kidding. But I, you know, you type in relaxation or something like that, and you get so many results that are just totally meaningless. And then you have free version and the paid version of everything. So you have two versions of app. You have to go and look, and like you were saying, you have to tap through, see what's in the free version, what's in the paid version, then go back and back out and all this stuff. And it's an onerous experience there. The other thing, you know, it's not necessarily something to fix, but it's very telling that on the desktop, you have iTunes and you have all the stores in one. On iOS, you still have three separate apps. You have the App Store app for apps. You have the iTunes Store for media. And then you have iBooks, which then connects you to the iBook Store by pressing the store button and flipping around.
Don't forget Podcasts, which also connects you to the podcast.
Oh, right. Now Podcasts is a separate app and is a fourth app. So now we have four different apps for accessing the content that you get from iTunes through one app through the store. And, you know, maybe there's good reasons because the experience is different on a mobile device versus on a desktop device. But it's somewhat telling that, not even talking about iTunes itself, but talking about the store, that there's four ways to get to the store on your iPhone and one way to do it on the desktop. And I think Apple somehow needs to bring those in line and make it easier for people to use the store both on the desktop.
A consistent experience regardless of what device you're accessing from.
You know, you still can't download and read books from the iBook store on your computer, but Apple has finally made it so that you can browse books and purchase them from your computer at least. So now you can do everything within the within iTunes from the iTunes store, but four different apps on iOS. And it's there's some craziness there.
Dan?
I think my focus would be really around the accounts, your iTunes store account. And I think, you know, for example, families, people with kids who want to download apps, you know, as you mentioned before, you know, Phil, you're getting to the point where you're probably starting to download apps that maybe your daughter wants to use. And then
I'm keeping the good folks at Toca Boca. They are going to get to name a boat after me.
I bet your daughter could give you a nice haircut or makeover now.
No, not according to the little cat on the Toca Boca hair salon. The cat does not seem pleased with the work, but continue, Dan.
The issue being that at some point, your daughter might end up having her own iOS device. Now, do you have to go back and buy all those apps again? Do you have to leave them Do you have to leave her logged into your account all the time? You start to run into problems when it's dealing with a family or more than one person who's sharing, an account or apps or something like that. I think that's starting to be more and more of an issue, especially as we're seeing more and more families where, you know, you might have your kids have separate devices, but, you know, they don't necessarily have it set up to use their own, you know, download their own apps. And maybe you want to not buy the same app for, you know, both of your kids, because why should you have to pay for the same app twice for both of your kids can use it? So I think there's a lot of complexity in there. And also I'll reference a piece on our site by it's our contributor, Kirk McLaren, who wrote a story.
He's the iTunes guy.
also known as the iTunes guy. But he commented how he was moving from one country to another and ran into a bunch of problems migrating his iTunes account in terms of what he was allowed to retain access to when he moved to a new country, which also, you know, granted, we get into the realm of legalities and all right. sorts of other issues of that sort.
That's
but
the lawyers,
at the same
man.
Time, they're, you know, they're if you're going to need to have this experience because people are, it's not just a niche market anymore, right? It's mainstream.
Yeah.
So if you move to another country and you can't, you know, access any of your apps anymore, that's a real problem.
As the editor of the iTunes guy column, who deals with Kirk's column every time it comes in, and also sees all of the questions submitted to our iTunes guy at macworld.com. And if you have any questions, please submit there. I see all the questions that come in, and I would say at least half, if not more, of the questions that come in to that account are about iTunes store accounts, Apple IDs, moving, families, kids with accounts, the stuff that you were talking about. At least 50% of the questions are about that because, one, Apple makes it really complicated, doesn't do enough to make it easy to share, move stuff, and also doesn't explain it as well as they could. So, you know, we're definitely not alone, and our readers seem very interested and have a lot of problems with the whole Apple ID and Apple Store, iTunes Store and account information stuff. So I see that every day.
Since John took my solution with the search improvements, I'll just throw out there. I wish that iTunes, the store, gave you the ability to open things in new windows or new tabs so that you weren't having to do so much scrolling back and clicking those arrows back and forth to get back to where you started from. I would like to basically have a more browser-like experience on when I'm looking for things on iTunes.
You mean something you could do in iTunes 10?
You only need one window. That's
yes.
all you need.
Let me throw out one last question there. It's something that I thought of while John was talking about the different experiences. Younger listeners and Dan Morin may not remember, but in the early 1980s, we had the Bell Telephone Company. And the federal government decided the Bell telephone company was too big and cut it into many, many regional pieces, broke up Ma Bell. And forget the fact that in the ensuing 2.5-3 decades, those companies have all merged again and are basically
pay no attention to the phone company behind the curtain.
There was no impact whatsoever. But is it time for Apple to kind of do that with iTunes and to split it, to break it up into pieces? Arguments for and against, John Seth.
I mean, I've heard so many people talk about iTunes as bloated. iTunes needs to be broken up into separate apps. But I don't know if that's really the solution. iTunes is, you know, it started as a media hub, you know, where your music was and then your video and your TV shows. And it became a syncing application for syncing for your devices and your Apple TV and all that stuff. And there are all these different parts. There's your podcasts and your books and your music and your movies. But if you have an iOS device, all those things are things you want to have on there. And Apple had an app called iSync, which if you ever had to use it to sync data with, you know, third-party phones back in the day, it was not a pretty app. And I don't feel like breaking out the sync part into another app makes sense. I just don't know that there's a lot of sense in taking all of the features that iTunes has and making them into separate apps. As we were talking about, we already have separate apps on iOS devices, and it doesn't necessarily make it easier.
I don't know that we need separate apps, but I think, you know, there's an argument for turning sync rather into something like a system preference pane or something like that, where you sort of pull, you know, in your system preferences on your Mac, you might just open this pane and then specify where all your sync stuff is coming from. And I could see that being one thing that could be removed. The sort of device component could be removed. The store is interesting. It's kind of, you know, we now have the Mac App Store, which is a separate app. And I think that, you know, I don't think most of us would argue that the Mac App Store should be folded into iTunes, certainly.
Oh, no.
But there is an argument for should there be an iOS App Store app separate from iTunes as a media player. And I can see John's point about it is convenient to have a lot of these things in the same place, but I do feel that iTunes has become overloaded and thus occasionally very confusing when you're trying to find something in particular. And things like, to me, the line for me was when you started having like PDFs in iTunes. Mm. And I don't believe you could actually ever open PDFs in iTunes. They always open in preview, but it's weird to have that as a sort of a file browser for the PDFs or like liner notes or.
Well, and you have them under the book section where you have ebooks,
right.
And then you have audiobooks under
right.
books.
You can't read your
PDFs.
Ebooks in the book section either because there's no iBooks on the Mac. So like, you know, this, my point is like it keeps building in more and more stuff. And I think to a certain extent you've over, you know, belabored the metaphor, if you will, of this being your media center. So I think that there are some smart, you know, perhaps some smart choices Apple could make about just carving out portions of these functionality and finding a better fit for them. I don't know that we necessarily need to break everything up into little tiny small pieces, but I think there are probably some things that would be better suited to being either in their own app or becoming more a part of the system. The other example I always think of is video. Like video, specifically video that you shoot videos on your iPhone. Those, it's kind of unclear where those should live. Should they live in iTunes? Should they live in iPhoto? Should they live in your folder on your hard drive, right? There's never been a really good, single solution for dealing with that.
Yeah, they don't live in iTunes unless you import them elsewhere, edit them, and then bring them into iTunes because iTunes doesn't import them when you plug your phone in.
Right.
But iPhone or Aperture will. Or
right, iMovie. But they don't quite belong in iPhoto either because you can't really do most of the things you want to do with a video in there either. So it's they kind of don't have a home. But it's one of those things where it's like there seems like there's some more consistency and some clearer lines that could be drawn.
And your host believes with every fiber of his being that the app portion of iTunes should probably be spun off because the process of managing and searching and downloading apps is quite different than looking for movies and TV shows and music, I think. I think we've exhausted the topic of iTunes, but listeners, that's not the only topic we're going to talk about today. No, no, you get bonus material right after this word from our other sponsor, and that sponsor is Squarespace, which offers easy website hosting and super simple web design. With oodles of easy-to-customize templates, a free domain name, and 24/7 customer support, it's easy to see why customers love Squarespace. You can literally drag photos from your Mac's desktop onto the Squarespace window to upload them to your website, and your site is automatically optimized for the iPhone and iPad too. Squarespace's unlimited plans offer the best value with unlimited pages, galleries, and blog, unlimited storage, bandwidth, and contributors. Go to squarespace.com/macworld to start a free trial. No credit card required. If you decide to purchase, click enter an offer code below the pricing at checkout and enter the offer code MACWORLD4 to get a 10% discount. That's squarespace.com/macworld. Offer code MACWORLD4. And the topic for the last portion of our podcast is T-Mobile. After we recorded our silly little pundit showdown last week, T-Mobile went and added the iPhone, becoming the last carrier to do so. And Dan Morin has covered that topic extensively at MACWORLD.com. So, Dan, what's the skinny? What do we need to know about the iPhone 5 on T-Mobile?
Well, the first thing you need to know is that the iPhone 5 goes on pre-order on April 5th, which is, as we record this, the coming Friday, and then on sale the following Friday, April 12th. There is some confusion about what, you know, if you've already got an iPhone 5 and you want to take it.
This is what I wanted to dig into.
This is what you want to get into. This is, well, all right. So here's the deal as I understand it currently. If you already have a AT&T iPhone, or an unlocked iPhone that you bought directly from Apple with no contract, which is the same model as the AT&T iPhone, they will, for the most part, work on the existing T-Mobile network, which is to say you should be able to get LTE speeds, which is the fastest 4G available. You should be able to also get what they call HSPA Plus But there are, here's where it gets tricky. There are two speed tiers of that. There's a 42 megabit per second tier and a 21 megabit per second tier. The current version works with the 21 megabit per second, but not the 42, which is also sometimes called DCHSDPA. I know, lots of letters, lots of speeds and numbers.
I hope
confusing.
People are writing this down for the quiz at the end of the podcast.
Well, you don't have to write it down because I've already written about it.
We'll include a link to the show notes so you can cheat during the quiz portion of the podcast.
It's an open note quiz.
Mm-hmm. So the basic deal of this is if you're in one of the markets covered by T-Mobile's LTE, you're in pretty good shape. When you need to fall back to a slower network, you probably won't get the fastest speeds you want. But honestly, you may not notice that much based on whatever carrier you're using right now. It probably won't be a huge difference, even for things like streaming video these days, just because that kind of stuff is really well optimized for these kinds of connections.
Now T-Mobile's I just want to jump in there. T-Mobile's LTE network is fairly nascent at this point, is it not?
Correct. Yeah, okay. They're still building it out. They're also building out. So prior to this, you might remember in the past that if you wanted to take your iPhone to T-Mobile, it meant that you were actually only getting edge speeds, which was the 2G, sort of even below 3G. And that was because T-Mobile used a different 3G frequency from pretty much anybody else out there. So that meant that you were pretty much limited back to the speeds that you got on like the original iPhone on AT&T back, 6 years ago. Starting last year, I think in the last year or two, T-Mobile has actually started building out a network that uses pretty much the same frequency as AT&T. So you can actually take advantage of that in between LTE and edge speeds these days. So you're in a lot better shape than you were a couple of years ago. If you want to get the whole shebang, the version of the iPhone 5 that Apple is releasing on T-Mobile on April 12th will cover everything. We'll work with every network T-Mobile has. That will also be, I believe, going forward, starting at that point, the AT&T models should also have that compatibility. So past April 12th, if you buy an AT&T or T-Mobile iPhone from Apple or one of those carriers, you should be getting one that works on pretty much either of those networks.
Now, what's this business I hear about no contracts now with T-Mobile?
So T-Mobile is claiming that they really, we're going to reinvent the phone industry. And the way they're doing that is by removing what's called subsidy. So previously, if you bought an iPhone or pretty much any cell phone, you usually signed a two-year service agreement. And the upshot of that two-year service agreement was that you paid a certain amount for the phone up front, which usually wasn't very expensive. I mean, you can get a free iPhone 4 or, $100 iPhone 4S or a $200 iPhone 5. And then, you're basically locked into this contract for 2 years. Now, the reason they do that, I mean, if you go look at the cost of an unlocked iPhone 5, it's like $650. So you're essentially getting a deal. Because you're going into the carrier and you're saying, I want to get this device, but I'm going to sign up with a contract with you, thus guaranteeing I'm going to be paying you every month for at least 2 years. And the carriers use that to recoup the cost of the phone, which they have subsidized. So they pay that extra $450 that it would have cost you to buy the phone unlocked, and you just sort of slowly pay them back over the course of 2 years. Now, what T-Mobile is doing that is slightly different is that they are making this much more about an installment plan for the phone. So you will still pay a cheaper cost up front, and you are still more or less locked into an agreement that you are going to stick around on this carrier. The difference is when your term expires, you have paid off the phone, and thus those monthly fees that you're paying will go down. So you may be paying, I believe you have to pay $200 up front for an iPhone 5, and then an additional $20 a month for 2 years. It works out to a little bit cheaper than it would cost to buy a full unlocked iPhone 5. And at the end of those 2 years, you no longer have to pay that extra $20 a month. So in effect, after you've paid off the phone, your monthly phone bill goes down. Now, keep in mind that depending on how this works, the life cycle of a phone is also a couple of years. So depending on how long you tend to keep and use your phones, that may or may not end up working out for you. And just because you're not signed into a contract as far as, the sort of traditional carrier service goes, doesn't mean that you don't have an obligation. you can't buy this phone for cheap and then just, you know, you can take off and leave T-Mobile, you know, but you're going to owe them money because you haven't paid off that phone that you bought. So you're still going to be making monthly payments, but you should be able to switch your service. So it's allowing a little more freedom and focusing a little more attention on the devices themselves. You know, it feels a little more like buying a car now where you sort of, you know, not quite take out a loan, but you're paying it off.
You have your monthly payments. Yeah.
Exactly. You got your monthly payments. And once that's done, you own that thing outright.
And that's when the car falls apart and you have to get a new one, beginning the cycle anew. So it sounds like that the people who would most benefit from this no contract approach as it's currently designed are people who don't necessarily upgrade to the latest and greatest phones every time one comes out, and kind of hold on to that phone you buy for, well, I was going to say 2 years, but probably longer than 2 years is when you really begin to see the cost savings.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, I think it's going to be over a longer term that you're going to see the benefit. Now, there also is some freedom in terms of if you want to switch. I mean, that's the other part of this is technically I believe you don't have a service contract. So if you decide you want to say, you know, T-Mobile's been okay, I want to go over to AT&T. You can leave T-Mobile, you know, before those 2 years are up. I mean, you're still going to be paying a monthly payment to pay off that phone. So it's not necessarily going to save you money. But if you want the freedom to, you know, switch carriers, then that may be more attractive to you.
Though not to Verizon and Sprint, we should say.
Correct.
They're on CDMA as opposed to GSM.
And they use different LTE bands as well. So you still need a different model of phone for that. So I think this is a baby step in terms of the phone industry changing. I do think it's significant, but I think that it's you know, it's just sort of another little chip away at the entrenched monopolies that we see from the carriers. I wrote about this a couple weeks ago in terms of how I think that this has been a big play for the iPhone over the long term of the last, you know, 6 years of its existence, is that it has kind of changed the way people think about buying phones and signing up for contracts and, you know, the entire marketplace. And so I think we'll see more shifts. It will be very interesting to see how AT&T and Verizon and Sprint react to this, whether they feel that they are secure enough in the way that they do business. Because after all, T-Mobile is the smallest of the four major carriers in the U.S. But it will be interesting to see how that drives the industry and whether or not these other carriers feel like they need to respond and come up with some way of, you know, offering some of these, you know, benefits to their current customers.
Dan, thank you for bringing clarity into the foggy morass of phone contracts. John Seff, still with us. Hi, John.
Oh, sorry. Here I am.
You haven't spoken in years. I was just going to thank you for joining us on the podcast.
I like being thanked.
I was going to thank Dan Morin as well.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you, listeners. Thank you to our sponsors. Hey, if you want to hear more podcasts, be sure to go to iTunes, which, as we pointed out, is a perfectly decent size and very easy to search, and look for the Play This podcast from our sister site, techhive.com. It's all about digital entertainment. We think if you were to draw the Venn diagram of Macworld podcast listeners and Play This podcast listeners, it would be a perfect circle. So download that and join us next week on the Macworld podcast. I'm Philip Michaels. Thanks very much for your time.